Good evening, everybody, and welcome. I have to ask, how many people here tonight ever at one time dreamed of being an astronaut? Round of applause. Awesome. Awesome. Well, tonight we're very lucky to do something that we have never done here before. Out on the flight line during the show, you'll see what we call our heritage flights, where you see the World War II or older aircraft, the legacy aircraft, flying alongside the cutting-edge jet that's going upward, above and beyond. And tonight we're doing a little bit of that ourselves. We're going to have a little bit of a heritage flight here talking about space flight and exploring the moon. Your MC, only at EAA do we have the luxury of saying, like, who should MC this panel? And we're like, oh, actually, one of our board members flew the shuttle 4 times, spent 40 days in space. Why don't we just go ahead and get him to do it? Which is, if you guys have been coming here for many years, you know I lean on Charlie a lot, but I'm very fortunate to call this man not only a leader, but also a friend and someone to look up to. So, ladies and gentlemen, a warm EA welcome to Charlie Precourt.
Good evening. How's everybody doing tonight? You enjoying the first day at the show? Fantastic. I think I saw a lot of hands go up for volunteers for the astronaut program, and I think you're going to see there's a lot of opportunity coming. NASA's going to explain to us how we moved from Apollo through shuttle and space station and on into Artemis. And it's a pretty exciting time. I want to invite out a very, very good friend of mine who is now the associate administrator at NASA, Bob Cabana, to join us to kick this off. Bob? Thank you, Bob. We have some more seats to fill here in a few minutes, but I want to start this off with Bob because he is the senior civil servant at NASA. He's also a former space shuttle commander himself. He used to be my boss when he was the chief of the astronaut program.
Remember that when you ask questions. Okay. I used to be your boss, Charlie.
That's right. And, you know, it's our privilege to have Bob here this evening, and you're going to see from Bob and these others that they have a real affinity for not only space but for aviation. And all of them have some connection to what we do here at EAA with flying little airplanes, flying bigger airplanes. Bob, I think you told me you had airplane envy walking the grounds today.
I have a 1978 Super Decathlon that I've totally restored.
How about that?
It's absolutely awesome. I do aerobatics whenever I can. But walking around the grounds here, I have definite aircraft envy. There are so many cool airplanes here. It's unbelievable.
But, he showed me some pictures of his restoration, and it is all the way down and all the way back up. It's a beautiful airplane, so congrats on that. So welcome, Bob, to the stage. Let's kick this off tonight. Before we bring the others out, let's kick it off with a little video about Apollo to Artemis. So Chris and company, can you roll that for us?
The landing to me was a great celebration. The nation was almost euphoric.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
There are so many things that we could eventually learn about our universe and the spacecraft that we use exploring.
We are a nation of explorers. During Apollo, we were on national TV literally every day because we were doing something visible that Americans could see and they could feel and say, look what we are doing. And I believe Artemis is going to come up and say, look what we are capable of and what we are doing now.
Artemis will stand on the shoulders of Apollo. They're going to have the eyes of the world on them when they start down this trail.
The science of a space flight is one that will continue to inspire. Going to the moon generates technology, more communications, more computer technology, more sophistication in manufacturing that help us in everyday life.
We have a generation that is ready, a generation with that technology, a generation with the education. Artemis represents the future in space. It is our next big step, and it is time to take it.
Thank you. Nicely done. So I think you're going to recognize a couple of faces in that video here in a minute, right? But Bob, from your perch at the top of NASA and with the strategy of where we've been, and we're going to look at some history, but we're going to look into the future, what is, in your mind, the key aspects of Artemis as we move into the next generation?
So Artemis is different from Apollo in that we're going back to the moon in a sustainable manner. It's not just for a 2 or 3 day camping trip. We want to be able to stay on the moon, utilize the moon's resources for fuel, oxygen, and create a lunar economy, if you will. We have so much more yet to learn on the moon. We're going for the science. One of the things that Pam Melroy, Deputy Administrator, another astronaut, in fact, she was here last year at EAA, Air Force test pilot, and just an amazing lady. And Pam is responsible for our moon to Mars architecture. And we're defining all the requirements, the objectives that we need to meet in order to eventually go on to Mars. Mars is the ultimate goal, and we're going through the moon to get there. And we've laid out this architecture such that it sustains administrations. It sustains shortfalls in funding. We may not get there at the exact same time, but there are certain things we have to do on each step, and it's well documented. You know, we had a very successful Artemis 1 test flight last November. An amazing rocket. The spacecraft went further from the moon, further from Earth than we've ever gone in a human-rated spacecraft. We're working through all the data. The rocket performed flawlessly, amazing. 8.8 million pounds of thrust. You know, and
it's hard to fathom.
It was a night launch, and I was in the LCC with the administrator and deputy administrator, and when we came out of the 10-minute hold, we didn't have anything to do after that, really. And I said, come on, we're going up on the roof. And we went up on the roof of the Launch Control Center and watched it. And if you've never seen a rocket launch, I tell folks, don't take pictures. Experience it. It is sight, sound, and feel. It is an emotional event. And Charlie, you and I have seen night shuttle launches before, and they are amazing. This was better than that.
It was awesome.
The next step, we're launching a crew next year on an Apollo 8 type mission. It'll be the first flight of SLS and the Orion spacecraft with a crew on board. It's a crew of four, and it's an amazing crew. It's Reid Wiseman, former chief of the astronaut office, on his second flight. Victor Glover, African American, naval aviator test pilot, his second flight. Christina Cook, amazing engineer, and it's her second flight. And then a Canadian, Jeremy Hansen. It'll be Jeremy's first flight. But we're going back to the moon in an international and industry partners. We're going together. We're not going just as the United States. We have our international partners with us, and we're bringing industry with us. And then we'll get a lander, and Artemis 3 is actually going to be boots on the moon, and that's going to be awesome. It's been over 50 years since we've been on the moon, 1972, when Gene Cernan made those famous remarks. I think it's about time we got back.
Yep, absolutely. Did you have a couple of words about how you picked Artemis?
Oh, absolutely. So the Apollo program, of course, back in the 60s and 70s. Artemis is the twin sister of Apollo. And as we're sending women and people of color, everybody's going back to the moon, right? And it was very appropriate that Artemis was named after a woman, Apollo's twin sister. It's a follow-on to Apollo. And I think that's the important thing. Everybody's going to be able to see themselves. EAA has been awesome. I talked to so many kids today. What EAA does, motivating young children, being able to see themselves in doing the things that we get to do, we want everybody to see that. We're going to inspire the next generation. We're from the Apollo generation. It certainly inspired us, but we want to inspire that next generation, the Artemis generation.
Nice. Thank you. Appreciate that. All right, thank you. Well done. Well, let's meet our other panelists and we'll get this rolling. Our first is Alex Kanellikas. And Alex is a young engineer who has an incredible resume. And you're going to find out that Artemis is in good hands with experts like Alex. He leads the Lunar Surface Flight Operations Program. And involved in that are all of the surface spacesuits, the rovers, the payloads, habitats. That's a big thing to take your hands on, right? But going back to Alex's roots, he's a Wichita State grad, right? And get this, perfect math score on his ACT and SAT tests. I think we're in pretty good hands when it comes to surface systems. That's awesome. Just a couple of words about your job today.
Yeah, well, talk about exciting. I got to bring my son out here, and he has just been going plane to plane, aircraft to aircraft, and enjoying it all. And I'm so excited to be here tonight. I got to meet some of my heroes that you'll get to meet here in a little bit. My job is really to lead the team for Lunar Surface Flight Operations. So we're the team that's training the crew, developing the facilities, and executing the mission and mission control for Artemis. And for the surface, like Jerry mentioned, we're concentrating on our spacesuits, the rovers, and all the science and payloads that we're going to do on the surface of the moon. And we're going back not only to do some science, but we're going back to also stay and then move on to Mars. It's a really exciting team. We're moving very aggressively. We're getting to dabble in some new facilities that will be used for the first time for dust mitigation and some microgravity and 1/6 gravity offload systems. So it's just a really exciting time to be part of the NASA mission.
That's fantastic. Congratulations. And is he 30 yet? Welcome. Great to have you here. The next one to join us is Dr. Ryan Watkins. Come on and join us, Ryan. So Ryan has a great story, too. And what I would say is you have just met a rocket woman. And I think if Elton John had known that you had been known as Rocket Woman, the song would not be Rocket Man today. It might have been Rocket Woman, right?
Yeah, just don't ask me to sing.
Don't ask you to sing, okay. So Ryan is the planetary scientist at NASA headquarters that manages the overall science goals that we're going to be doing on the lunar surface. And she leads what we call the Lunar Discovery and Exploration Program. And she'll be the lead scientist for Artemis 3, I think, right? Is that close?
Not lead scientist, no, but I am helping define the science for Artemis 3, yes.
Awesome. So say a little bit about your background with, in particular, using photometry to assess landing site hazards and so forth to allow us to land on the moon.
Yeah. So my background is in lunar science, specifically using remote sensing. And you mentioned the word photometry. So this is just our fancy word for looking at how bright a surface of a planet is. And so I've used this technique of looking at the reflectance of the moon to understand how rocket exhaust interacts with the surface of the moon in order to understand landing site safety as well as any implications that has for science. And like you said, now I'm working at NASA headquarters. My office runs the Lunar Discovery and Exploration Program. So we're sending instruments to the moon on commercial companies, commercial landers, as well as defining the science that Artemis is doing. And so I'm helping run the Artemis Deployed Instruments Program as well. So we'll be selecting some instruments that the crew will actually take and deploy on the surface of the moon to help us better understand.
Fantastic. Wow.
Can I throw in a quick comment?
I think you should.
So we're not going to the moon next year. We're actually going this year. She mentioned the CLPS mission, the commercial landers with NASA science on board, Astrobotics up in Pittsburgh, and Intuitive Machines down in Houston. Hopefully we'll be landing landers on the moon by the end of this year.
Nice. Beautiful. Congrats.
Yeah, exciting times.
Welcome. Thanks for being here tonight. Our next participant is Dr. John Blevins. Come join us, John. It's here for John. So John's the chief engineer of the Space Launch System rocket, which you can see on the far end over there. And he's near and dear to my heart because those two white boosters came out of the company that I used to work for, Northrop Grumman. And John's got some pretty good stories about managing the rocket, and we'll hear some more about that tonight. But before we get there, you're also an RV-10 builder, right?
Well, a partial RV-10 build. It's not done yet.
Okay.
But we did build one that's flying in Brazil and Christian missions down there, so I got to be a big part of that one. That was a great experience, too. That's back when the RV canopy was pink, so that's been a while. So.
Well, welcome. Great to have you here. Our next is Rick Weiss, who is well-known to the EAA community, former board member at EAA, as well as a... Welcome, Rick. Oh, you got a cheering squad out there. You picked them? You paid them? Okay. Rick was on the Home Bill Council for many years, and he was on the board here at EAA and worked with me in the safety committee activities. And he also has this really cool airplane. Can we show a picture of that? So this is Rick's RV, right?
RV-7A.
RV-7A, and look closely at the paint job on the belly. Nice. So there's more, because you were a rocket engineer during Apollo, and we'll hear a lot of stories about that tonight, but
I was,
a little bit of your 20s when you were in Apollo.
Yeah, they told me when I got to KSC that I was the youngest NASA engineer they hired. I was 21, barely. It was nice, though. I'd go out and drink with everybody. And I got there, and I had the choice of anything I wanted to work on, which was pretty cool. So they took me around in one day, took me to all the offices, and I picked the S1C because you could see the flames, the fires, and feel it. So I ended up as an S1C mechanical and propulsion engineer, and I was on all the manned Apollo launches, and in the firing room for half of them, and I was a forward observer on a number of them, which was quite the thrill. And I'm honored to be here with this esteemed crowd, because I was just a 21-year-old engineer, and I'm here with center directors and astronauts. It's just mind-boggling.
Well, but welcome. Great to have you, Rick. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, and let's move on to Randy Bresnik, astronaut Randy Bresnik, comrade. Welcome. So Randy joined, I think you joined the astronaut program in 2004, is that right? And he's a F-18 test pilot and deployed to Kuwait and did a bunch of combat missions for us over there, thanks to your service, part of Iraqi Freedom. Flew on STS-129, did some spacewalks relative to space station assembly and so forth, right? Or maintenance and so forth. And then he's been on ISS Expeditions 52 and 53, where he was commander of the space station crew most recently. So welcome, Randy. Great
Thanks,
to have
sir.
You. All right. We're going to bring someone out you saw in the video. That's Jerry Griffin. So Jerry, please join us. Jerry, of course, was Apollo flight director and served as a flight director on all of the Apollo manned missions, right? And he's got some stories to tell, and probably about some astronaut stories, too. you led Apollo 12, 15, and 17 as a lead flight director, and then also as part of the Apollo 13 recovery for Jim Lovell's crew after the incident on orbit there. You helped bring that crew home with a team that you led in the background to make sure everything fit correctly for that recovery. So welcome, Jerry, to the stage this evening. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Let me begin by saying it's an honor to be here. I've known this place most of my adult life, my first visit.
So, that's awesome. Thank you.
It's really great. The best job I ever had at NASA was being a flight director in Mission Control for the first time we went to the moon and with humans. It was so much fun. It was nerve-wracking on a few occasions. But then later when I moved up the management chain, the fun got a little bit less. You had to deal with budgets and personnel problems and all that. But that was a great honor, too. But I just want to say it was an honor to be a part of Apollo.
Thank you, Jerry. Thanks for your service. And thank you. You're no stranger to airplanes either. I hear you got a story about a Super Cub that's in works.
Yeah, Super Cub built in 1959, remanufactured in 1985, and redoing another remanufacture as we speak.
Awesome. Congratulations.
A lot of fun.
Thank you. All right, so I want to invite to the stage Charlie Duke. Charlie, come join us. Charlie, welcome. It's an honor to have you here tonight.
Thank you very much.
We all know you for your mission to the moon, and we're going to hear a lot about that tonight. But a little bit about your background getting you into NASA.
I was a Naval Academy graduate. When I graduated, you could go in the Air Force. And my senior year, I got a physical, and they said, you don't qualify for Naval Aviation, but the Air Force will take you. So I went in the Air Force and never regretted that decision, never looked back. And fighter pilot, then MIT, where I met some astronauts that gave me the motivation to go to apply for a test pilot school. And then from there, 2 months later, this was 1965, and I read an article in the front page of the Los Angeles Times says NASA's picking more astronauts. And I said, that's me. And so I applied and got selected. So that's the story.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thanks, Charlie. Thanks for sharing that. I'd like to kick this off to show a video from your mission with John Young on the Apollo 16 flight. So could we roll that video just briefly here?
Look around and see if you see any of the thicket of basalt.
That's what I'm looking for.
Good show. I told him you were.
What? Okay.
We see that one went all the way in.
Not quite.
Now that was tricky.
There he is, all but about.
So Charlie, I got to ask. That was John, right? And that's you. Okay, I thought I heard John's voice there, but
he's talking to him.
He's talking to him. Okay. So how did you train to get up like that? That's quite the deal.
I'm sorry. What was
how that? Did you train for the recovery maneuver there to get up off the surface?
Oh, yeah. we did that in a zero-G airplane, Can You Get Up? And when you fall forward, you just took a series of push-ups. And then on your back, I fell over once on my back at the end, and that was really scary.
Whoa.
And John had to come over and help me up, but my heart was really pounding. I'm glad I didn't have to do that. I didn't do that more than once. Mission Control was really upset. And that Something ended the Moon Olympics, by the way.
Yeah, it was something they had never trained for. And I remember you telling me when you got back, don't do anything you haven't trained for.
Yeah.
And
all of you future astronauts, never do anything in space you haven't practiced on Earth.
There you go. That's great.
So Alex. We're actually using that video to help inform our future spacesuit manufacturers that we're going to fall. And the design to fix that
might be the case. So, and then, you know, you can tell looking at the suit too. There's like quite a bit of dust there, and that's quite a thing to manage. I imagine
it was, real dusty. We landed in the Descartes Highlands and in the mountains of the moon, though it doesn't look like it's very mountainous. It was a high altitude, and soil. There's no soil up on the moon. It's just pulverized rock, actually, very very fine, like powder. And as you can see, you kick up dust as you walk and you fall down and you pick up stuff and it gets all over your suit and you cannot brush it off. It's so fine grained, even though we had that outer protective cover, we ended up later on in the mission, you look at us and we gray color instead of white. So it was a real problem and you tracked a lot of that stuff back in the spacecraft. And it wasn't a problem on the moon, but when we got back in orbit, we had this cabin full of dust floating around. And so we stayed in our environment, buttoned up in a suit. So when we docked with Mattingly, he opens the hatches and he looks in. He says, "You not coming in here." And he floated a vacuum cleaner over and shut the door. And so we vacuumed up everything, and we opened. He opened it up and said, "Okay, you can come over now."
Awesome. Well, Ryan and Alex, about the surface of the moon, and have we made some progress in being able to control this stuff and in the future?
Well, like Charlie said, lunar dust it can be a bit of a pain. So not only is it very fine grained, it's also very jagged because there are no weathering processes on the moon. There's no water, no wind to really, you know, wear it down and round out the edges. So this also helps it to then you get lodged in spacesuits and mechanisms and instruments, et cetera. Makes it a hazard when you bring it into your spacecraft. And so, yes, we are starting to make advances. You know, there's research being done in like electrostatic ways to clear dust off of, you know, solar panels and spacesuits and things, and I don't know if you want to add anything about that.
Yeah, and so some of the modules that we're building, some of the parts of the Artemis mission, they're not going to just be used for one mission. They're going to be used over and over, so that even makes this dust problem more concerned. So we want to make sure that we can train our astronauts, so we're looking into facilities of how can you get a crew member that's in a spacesuit, offloaded, pressurized, and be able to you know, use electrostatic discharge or compressed air or gas to remove the dust off the suits before you enter the vehicle.
Thank you. That's great. So, Charlie, I got to ask you, do you recognize this by chance?
Yeah, the moon boot.
So they tell me that that's your boot, and I'm just wondering if we might want you to try it on and prove to us that
yeah,
it's yours.
Yeah, it's got my name in here. Yeah. Is that the flight boot?
That's not a flight boot. Had two that they tell me. You had two that you flew with? Two pairs?
Yeah, we had a flight boot and we had a training boot.
And so this was the training boot.
Probably the training one.
Yeah.
I mean, without these on, your suit wouldn't have survived.
Is that right?
Yeah, because of the grittiness of the dust. And it was a real problem. And I think in Artemis, they got to have to be careful. Hopefully they got an airlock so they can leave everything outside or out in the airlock and get it back into space.
Is that the plan?
Do you have an airlock?
We're pushing for that.
It's really important.
I hope this is recorded so we can share it.
Well, we've got another clip on the moon, but Jerry, before we go to that, any most memorable moments during the lunar excursions, during the missions that you might want to share with us?
That's a hard one to answer because 13 was so different.
Yeah, 13 was so
but
different.
Let me set that one aside.
Yeah.
Apollo 12, we got struck by lightning.
Oh, yeah.
And twice while we're on the Saturn rocket going up. I was on duty with my goal team, and I thought we were going to have to abort. But thank goodness the Saturn was the primary guidance system. And the lightning didn't get it. It got us. And I was watching the, we called it the V-gamma plot, velocity versus flight path angle. And it was right on the money. So we were going uphill just fine. So I said, you know, don't abort too early.
Yeah.
In the meantime, some of you have probably heard the expression SCE to AUX. John Aaron, young flight controller, from Southeastern Oklahoma State University, I think. He was 24, 25 maybe. Made the call. Have the crew try SCE to AUX. Our data was frozen. And I looked at Jerry Carr, who was the Capcom. I kind of frowned at John. He had turned around and looked at me. I looked at Jerry Carr, and I said, Capcom SCE to AUX, and Jerry looked at me the same way. None of us knew where the switch was or what it was. And we never simmed it, never used it. And so Jerry reads it up to Pete Conrad, who was the commander, try SCE to AUX. And Conrad said, NCE to AUX. What the hell is that? And so anyway, Jerry repeated it. he got it right that time. Al Bean, who was sitting in the right seat, knew where he was, went SCE dogs, and that changed the signal conditioning equipment, SCE, to an auxiliary set. And we got our data back. We could then solve all the issues. We got everything cleaned up by the time we got to orbit. And then the decision was, do we go to the moon?
Nice.
And I never will forget Chris Kraft, who is the director of flight ops, came down and said, Jerry, we don't have to go to the moon today. And it was his way of saying, you're called, do what you think's right, but we don't have to. I said, oh, okay. And we went. And the mission was beautiful after that.
Fantastic.
It was,
thanks.
It was
thanks
a great,
for
great
that.
Moment.
Great.
And I was my first Saturn launch.
Well, in those times, we had lots of 20 to 30-year-olds working in the control room on their very first jobs, a lot of them, right?
Yeah, I was 34.
Wow.
On Apollo 12.
That's pretty impressive. Let's show another video here, Charlie, of you and John on the moon. And this one, not to kick up a feud between the Air Force and the Navy, but I think there's some nice little banter going on here. Oh, can we get the audio?
I'd like to see an Air Force salute, Charlie, but I don't think they salute the Air Force.
Sir, we do. And fly high and straight and land soft.
Okay, Charlie, say when.
Here we go.
Good again.
One for you. Okay, wait a minute, one more.
This looks like a good time for some good news here. The House passed a space budget yesterday, 277 to 60, which includes a vote for the shuttle.
Wonderful. Yeah. Tony, again, I'll say it with absolute, I'm proud to be an American. I'll tell you, what a program, and what a place, and what an experience.
Yeah, and I'll say it too. So am I. The country needs that shuttle mighty bad.
So a pretty interesting comment about there you are saluting, and the vote comes up from the Congress that they're going to finance the space shuttle.
The shuttle was announced while we were on in that scene right there. And you missed the fun part. John was he got his picture taken first, and I said, come on out here, John, give me a big Navy salute. So he trotted out and saluted, and he jumped off the moon. If you look at the shadow, he's about a foot off the moon. And he did it twice, and so we were really excited. I wasn't about to jump at that point. I just saluted. Anyway,
I thought your comeback was great when he said, you Air Force guys don't salute. That was pretty good.
Oh, yeah, we do. We salute and smartly, and we land soft.
That's right.
All right, and I'll give you guys one data point that didn't get mentioned earlier when Charlie introduced me. And I only mention it so you guys can gauge the rest of my answers the rest of the night. I did not get a perfect score on my SAT in math. Right? So, you know, we took the shuttle and built the space station. And then on space station, now we've been, 24 years, the space station's been up there continuously with humans on board. And we're using it as a test bed for everything we're doing beyond low Earth orbit. For example, the exact toilet, we have it's called WHC, the Waste and Hygiene Compartment on space station, that mimics the one that's on the Russian segment. That's the one that's been up there for 20 years. For the last 3 years, we've had the toilet, or the Universal Waste Management System, UWMS, that is the exact twin of the toilet that is on the Artemis II vehicle today and will fly with the crew when they fly next year. So we are being able to do checkouts on that system and understand how it works and be able to buy down our risk and get some reliability on it. Whether it is the
and
reclamation.
By the way, with the porta potties on the site, I think they can all relate to just how important that toilet is, right?
Yes, and if you remember at the start of the program, we had the septic tank truck out back cleaning everything up, so that everybody will appreciate that in the morning. But the water reclamation systems, where we take and purify the urine that's collected on board so that today's coffee can become tomorrow's coffee, those are the types of things that, as you know, when you carry liquids on your aircraft, whether it be fuel or water or boxes of soda, that's a lot of weight. And so if we're able to reclaim the water we take with us and reuse it over and over again, then that's something that really will make it a lot more easy to be able to put down landers and habitats and, you know, have a continuous presence somewhere if we're not having to truck up water all the time that we're using and then venting overboard.
And I don't know how many folks are familiar with this, but that reusability of all the resources and recycling is really incredible and something that I think can find its way into our homes here on Earth, and we just become ever more efficient. It's really incredible science that's been done there.
And actually, you know, there's direct application to stuff here on Earth, especially they've been using that technology in Africa and other places, and probably will be more widespread as we make it more usable, and we're getting to the point where we can get into the 90s with a 95% reclamation. So these are the types of systems that allow humans to go farther and live longer away from our home planet because we're able to more efficiently use what we have.
Thank you. That's great. Rick and John, let's talk a little bit about the rocket and the evolution of the rocket engineering. Rick, any major memories to share from the development time frame with the rocket and the Saturn V?
I might have. some little known fun facts. How's that?
Sounds great.
There was, I think it was Apollo 10. For those who don't know Wernher von Braun, he was a German World War II rocket man, to say the least. And when the war was over, the U.S. absconded him. He ended up in Huntsville, Alabama, actually, I think somewhere else. But he ended up in Huntsville and was the father, essentially, of the Saturn V rocket. And so one weekend night, there was a miscommunication between the ground side on headquarters and the launch pad area. And they shut off the high-pressure nitrogen system, which allowed valves in our fuel tank on the first stage to open because it needed pressure to stay closed. And the fuel dropped from the tank down to the main valves in the engine. And when it did that, the pressure went negative inside the tank, and it collapsed. And this is after a countdown demonstration test, which is usually 2-3 weeks away from launch. And we had another system on the pad in an emergency that would repressurize the tank. And it kicked in, it took a while, but it repressurized the tank, and what was collapsed now expanded. So it was quite the ordeal. And von Braun came out, since he was on the development of it and the head of the Marshall Space Flight Center, and I happened to be on the watch that day, and he developed this standpipe that went up the side of the rocket and about 30 feet above it. We filled, this is the short story version, we filled the tank again with RP-1. The tank holds about 203,000 gallons of fuel, which is enough to get you from here to Milwaukee in most cars. But we filled it up, and once it gets to the top of the tank, you'd think that's the max pressure, but it's not. We had to proof test it. So we went up to the top of the rocket plus about 30 feet, pressurized the tank. It didn't burst, fortunately. Vented out the fuel and said it was okay to launch. This is after a few inspections too. So
wow.
That was
gutsy
my first
move.
Encounter with Wernher von Braun. I had
move.
Another one too. But
that's amazing. Gutsy
it
move.
Was. Little known facts. Yeah. We didn't broadcast that because we screwed up so badly.
So John, is that in your lessons learned book for SLS by chance?
I actually did know that story. So we're not going to do that with our fuel tank and the hydrogen tank, I assure you. And if you've seen our structural test of the hydrogen tank, and I encourage all of you to go to YouTube and Google or whatever, check out SLS hydrogen structural tank, and you will see that thing rip open. It was a factor of safety of 2.5. We've got quite a interesting tank there, and it's 5/8 inch thick aluminum alloy, and it's rippling like a piece of paper when it opens up with only 4 PSI on the inside of that structural tank. So we've done a whole lot of testing, as you know, Charlie. In fact, I remember coming out to your place and us setting a mountain on fire.
Exactly.
So at least once. So so it's been a fun ride on the
3.5 million pounds of thrust or more, right?
It was indeed, yes. 3.5 million pounds of thrust coming out of just one motor.
One motor, yeah.
And we've got two of those on the rocket and then four of the RS-25s.
And you were just telling me beforehand here that the performance of the rocket on Artemis 1 was really right on, I hear, right?
Yeah, it was actually amazing. The measure that we use for energy is mostly velocity, as you know, in rockets. And we were, you know, basically 1,000 nautical miles by 100 nautical miles, big elliptical orbit on this. We hit the velocity mark at 99.974% of the target.
Wow.
And by the way, when you're going that fast, you've got to cut it off sometime, so you never hit 100.
Yeah.
So we were only 30 milliseconds, essentially, from the perfect shut off command. And that's the first time we ever flew the system. So really great performance from the software and all of the rocket hardware.
Well, the crew, that's great. Thank you. And I can tell you the crews, all the astronauts really appreciate that kind of precision because there's nothing like an underspeed to get you really worried, right? Where are we going? We didn't quite make our target, but that's awesome. So Alex and Ryan, how about the landing on the surface? What are some of the key things? We're going to go to the South Pole, right? Why did we choose that? What are some of the key learnings that we're after there? And what do you anticipate as we go there?
Yeah, like you said, we're going to the south polar region of the moon. A couple of reasons we chose this area. One of the main ones being that this area is there's evidence for volatiles, so things like water ice, hidden in what we call permanently shadowed regions. So these are primarily in areas that are in craters that never see sunlight. So this, you know, allows water and water ice to kind of be maintained there. So this is of interest for crewed exploration because it gives us the opportunity to potentially use these resources. I think it was mentioned earlier for like rocket fuel and water and other things that can sustain human exploration for longer periods of time. This is also a previously unexplored area of the moon. There's a lot we don't know about the South Polar region in terms of the geology and the regolith. I mean, we just talked about dust, but we don't know how the dust may behave differently down there. We'll be close to some of the oldest parts of the moon, so we'll be able to date those and put some good age constraints on these really old terrains that will really help to anchor the chronology on the moon. And we actually use information about the age of the moon's surface to date other planetary bodies. So it's really important that we get these ages right as we go and then date surfaces on other planets. So yeah, like you said, we're going to South Polar region, going to look at these resources and do a lot of really great science. Is there anything you want to add, Alex?
Yeah, so you know, we're going to the South Pole, which is a very different region than we went in Apollo. Where Apollo was an equatorial region, the South Pole has a different environment. It's very stark contrast between light and the shadows. There's about a 2-degree sun angle, and so it's like me staring at these lights, and I can't even see, you know, the audience out here. But it's really hard for our eyes to adapt to those differences in lighting. So that's one thing that we're expecting to have to develop countermeasures for. Also, like Ryan said, we're going to some of the coldest places in our solar system, actually. And so we're having to develop our systems, our rovers, the boots on our spacesuits so that they can withstand these temperatures that are very, very extreme.
Excellent. So we have suits here. We got Charlie's suit, and then you've got the one you're developing there. Can you give us just a brief synopsis of what you've taken away from this one to that one and why that one's the way it is?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of the parts of Artemis is great because we can learn from Apollo. We've gotten to bring some of our Apollo crew members and flight controllers and flight directors on site and discuss with them what are some of the lessons learned. A great example is like on Charlie's flight, there was a very sensitive experiment called ALSEP. And this experiment had a long ribbon cable that was very finicky, and it ended up getting damaged. And part of the reason it got damaged was, one, we developed the system so that it could get damaged, and two, we couldn't see, the crew members couldn't see their feet. It was very difficult to see right in front of you. And so our new suit is developed so that you can see your feet, you can see right in front of you. It also has bearings in it that can allow you to get down on the ground, kneel down, and right up to the science. That was one of the main reasons we're going back to that region, so that you can take samples, you can observe closer to some of the rock samples that we're going to collect. And then overall, just the avionics packages are a vast difference between the two suits. With technology, we're able to enhance our avionics, enhance some of our redundancies in the systems, and we're looking for things like navigation. Since it's going to be so dark in these shadows, it's going to be difficult to navigate, and so we're looking into heads-up displays and things like that to enhance our crew members and allow them to achieve the mission that we want.
Excellent. So, Randy, the crew's training in some of this stuff now already, and the first crew for Artemis obviously is probably well underway. What kinds of things are they doing in preparation for the mission?
Well, as far as the suits go, we're still in development phase. Okay. In fact, I was in that suit in the underwater in the world's largest swimming pool, the Nutrabuoyancy Lab, just this past Wednesday.
Okay.
And it's true. I mean, you can get down on one knee, pick something up. You could get down on both knees. You don't have to do the push-up maneuver to get up.
You don't have to be a gymnast back, like Charlie
you
was.
You just roll over on your side and then get to one knee and then get up. So it's, the mobility is really incredible. And then we have now two vendors building our suits. Collins is going to go ahead and build the one that's for the zero gravity, go to replace the one on the space station, but they also will start working on a lunar surface suit. Axiom Company's building the lunar surface suit, but then they'll also be working a backup for the zero gravity suit. So that's one effort. As far as the Artemis II crew, though, they're not going to be going to the lunar surface. So they, you know, the thing, if you didn't realize, the Artemis II crew, November 24 is our target. They're going to go around the moon in a figure eight type of profile like Apollo 8 did. But it's also the first flight of the Orion vehicle with humans on it. So it's really a combination of Apollo 7 and 8 at the same time on the first mission. And so when people think that NASA's gotten really reluctant and, you know, not taking risks, well, we're taking risks, but they're calculated risks, and we're, you know, buying down as much of the risk as possible and still flying our mission safely. But we're going big, you know, on this first mission. And Artemis 3, right now we're targeting to put the first humans back on the moon since 1972. Well, that's flying to the moon on Orion, getting into the NRHO orbit, docking with a lander, but returning to the lunar surface. Well, that's Apollo 9, first flight of the LEM, 10, practice getting into lunar orbit, and 11 in the landing. So that's three Apollo missions in one Artemis mission. And so they are very complex missions with a lot of moving parts, but because of the technology, training, and everything we've learned from Apollo, we're able to take those challenges and make them possible. You know, because we know, we stand on the shoulders of giants. Well, these gentlemen next to us in Apollo are the ones whose shoulders we stand on, because Apollo, when they went, they didn't know it was possible. You know, they didn't know if the lunar module would sink into a cloud of lunar dust. We never see Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin again. Because of what they did, we know we can do that and take these big challenges and make them happen. And so the Artemis II crew is getting ready for the first flight of the vehicle. They're going to be going up into a high Earth orbit and checking out all the environmental control and life support systems, the pressurization, the toilet, the exercise device, and all these things to make sure that it's safe to leave low Earth, leave Earth orbit. So we're taking a big high elliptical 24-hour orbit around the Earth on this first flight. But then after the next pass, we come around, and if everything checks out, we're burning TLI, the translunar injection burn, and that puts them on a pathway around the moon, which is free return. So they head out, they don't have to do any burns to be able to come back to Earth. The lunar gravity captures them, slingshots them around, and sends it back to Earth. And that 10-day mission will open the door and prove the humans on Orion to be able to put us on the moon on the next flight.
Thanks, great description, appreciate that. Yeah, and speaking of buying down risk, thank you. Nicely done. You spoke about buying down risk. We've had a very successful Artemis 1 flight. We've got a nice summary clip here I'd like to show, and then several of you can comment on the stepping stone from Artemis 1 going forward. So let's roll that.
This is a whole new vehicle, a whole new technology, a whole new purpose of going back to the moon in preparation to go to Mars. And yes, it's hard.
Today, we make history with the launch of the most powerful rocket the world has ever seen. We are taking the first step in humanity's return to the moon.
We have worked really hard to get here. The team has done an absolutely outstanding job, and we're up to the challenge, and I'm really looking forward to a successful test flight.
You are looking at the world's most powerful rocket and Orion spacecraft live on Launch Pad 39B.
And here we go.
10.
Hydrogen burn-off igniters initiate. 7, 6, 5, 4-stage engine start. 3, 2, 1. And liftoff of Artemis 1.
its mission, Orion reached speeds traveling about 30 times as fast as the speed of sound.
This dramatic video of the Earth-Moon transit that took place showed and punctuated the fact that we were pressing away from our home planet to a distance of some 268,000 miles away from Earth, further than any human-rated spacecraft had ever traveled, for a spacecraft designed to return humans to Earth, eclipsing the mark set by the Apollo 13 vehicle back in 1970. A journey that began with the power of the launch of the Space Launch System 25 and a half days ago, about to reach its final minutes in the searing heat of re-entry, where temperatures around Orion will build up to 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And there it is, high over the Pacific, America's new ticket to ride to the moon and beyond now in view. Orion under its chutes descending towards splashdown. Splashdown. From Tranquility Base to Taurus Littrow to the tranquil waters of the Pacific, the latest chapter of NASA's journey to the moon comes to a close. Orion, back on Earth.
Oh, it's a new day. A new day has dawned. An Artemis generation is taking us there.
That's in the history books. It's happened, and I wanted to make sure people got to refresh their memory that we've actually done this. And we talked about how great the rocket performed, but are there any things, Bob or Randy, John, any of you that saw happen in this flight that you would tweak for Artemis II, things that you're going to do different? What are the lessons learned that we need to take forward with the experience from Artemis I?
Well, we are not complete in our analysis of the data on the Orion capsule. We still have...
Yeah, because I think a lot of people, you know, we launched it, they see the launch, and Orion's out there for a bunch of days doing a lot of work, right?
Overall, it performed phenomenally. I don't know if anybody watched the reentry when it was coming back in, but it was amazing watching it live. The Earth just kept getting bigger and bigger. I mean, you could see real time how fast it was going coming back into the Earth. We did a skip reentry, and that allows us more cross range, which allowed us to target landing right off the coast of San Diego. And so the vehicle came in, heated up, bounced back up, cooled off, and then came back in a second time and heated up again. And we're still analyzing the impact of that on the heat shield and how it performed. It had plenty of margin. The temperatures were well, and I forget what the limit was, but it fluctuated next to nothing compared to what was predicted. So, but we still got some analysis to do. And there's one part of the environmental control system that's being added. As Randy said, it's really important that highly elliptical orbit that we do around the Earth to check everything out to make sure that all the systems are working as they should before we do that translunar injection burn and make that Apollo 8 maneuver around the moon. So crew training, there's still a lot going on, and the team is working hard. We, the mobile launcher sustained a little damage. The loads were, the blast loads from the rocket taken off were a little more than anticipated.
It's almost 9 million pounds of thrust, right?
8.8 million pounds of thrust every time.
That's incredible.
But who's counting?
So they're making changes to it. We are also adding, because we did not fly with a crew on Artemis 1, we're adding a crew escape system to the mobile launcher out at the pad, and it'll be a slide wire system with buckets like we did for shuttle. So that's being attached to the mobile launcher. Right now we're looking to roll out to the pad from the VAB with the mobile launcher at the end of August for continued checkout out at the pad, check out the crew escape system and so on. So, you know, continuing to make modifications and improvements as we march down the line and learn from what we've accomplished.
So Charlie and Jerry, go ahead, Randy.
I was going to say the enormity of that flight should not be lost on us. And we didn't have a spare SLS. We didn't have a spare Artemis 1. You know, truly, failure was not an option. It was one of those things where all of us, the Artemis generation, we needed that flight to go well, or there's a chance that, you know, we lose the moon. And so that's why this flight, you know, with the accuracy of the launch, the performance of the SLS was amazing. Orion itself had 121 test objectives that we had planned to do on the flight. It went so well, during the flight, we added an additional 20 flight test objectives, which, as you know, from flight test, typically never happens. You're lucky to get through, 80% of your data points. And so that was huge. But it's adding all the things like the life support system we talked about, the displays for the crews to actually operate, the flight controls, the manual control that needs to be tested out. And just like you do on airplanes, standard Cooper Harbor ratings, the Artemis II crew is going to be doing right after they launch and use their second stage rocket as a test bed to check out the flying qualities. So on Artemis III, when you actually have to rendezvous with another spacecraft in lunar orbit, we know what it's going to be like.
Fantastic. Thank you. Chris, do we have a couple of questions from the audience that you've teed up?
We do. Stand by 1 second here. Let's take a look. Boy, we had our own SCE auxiliary back here, so stand by. All right. How has the mentality and focus of NASA changed from the Apollo space race to Artemis now? And what has remained very much the same?
Sounds like it's a reference to then was a race, now is different. Jerry?
The space race of the 60s and early 70s, it was there, but I can say we never focused on it. It's a little bit, we never cared. I guess we cared. We didn't pay much attention to what the Soviet Union was doing. We had our own problems. We had to play our game. And not try to play theirs at the same time. We just didn't have enough time. And I thought, we didn't know it, but at Apollo 8, when we circled the moon with Borman, Lovell, and Anders, for all intents and purposes, the space race was over. Mm-hmm. We didn't know it at the time. They had had their big rocket blow up, and it not only took out their launch pad and their big rocket, it took out a building that had some of the flight controllers in it and got them too. We found that out some years later. So we were, we were fortunate. We got our nose bloodied. We really bloodied in Apollo 1 with the fire on the pad. But after about 2 years down, we didn't fly for almost 2 years. We got it fixed, much improved spacecraft, and we went on. Then we, every flight, this was kind of interesting, and Artemis guys are going to face the same thing. Every flight had problems. It just depended on, some of them were nagging, but you build up enough nagging problems that it gets kind of major. But we were able, even after Apollo 13, when the oxygen tank blew up, we were only down about 10 months on that one and got it fixed and flew again. So, I think the scar tissue builds up. Artemis is going to stub their toe somewhere. I mean, if you fly long enough, it's just like airplanes. Hopefully it won't be a bad one or anything like that, but it's a tough business, it's full of risk. And so that's what you gotta manage, but you never can manage it to zero. You can get awfully close.
Wow.
So what we accomplished during Apollo, what the Apollo team did was absolutely amazing with slide rules, right? The young people graduating today have so many more tools that we didn't have back then, but they are no less dedicated. They are motivated, they are enthused, they want to see this happen. I mean, look at them.
I know.
And they're every bit as motivated and dedicated as the team that made Apollo happen. But we're building on the experience of the past with new technologies, with an extremely dedicated team. So although it's different, I think in many ways it's the same. It's the same NASA team that's making this happen.
And I think there's a lot of inspiration that came out of Apollo that created a generation of engineers and scientists for the nation that was just huge. And Ryan, I'd just ask you, what inspired you about the program to put you where you are today?
Yeah. Well, when I like to talk about how I got to where I am today, I usually say that every little kid wants to be an astronaut when they grow up, and I never outgrew it. But I've never got to say that, actually, sitting next to astronauts. For me, I had a really great science teacher in middle school. It was eighth grade. I decided that I fell in love with space. And I decided then, I was like, I want to be an astronaut when I grow up. So I started researching careers that could lead you to that path, but also realizing that I needed to choose a career that I would love and enjoy, even if I never made it to, being an astronaut. So that led me to studying physics. I later pivoted to planetary science after doing some internships actually at NASA, because I really liked just being able to hold, a piece of another planetary body, in my case the moon, like in my hands. That's really kind of what got me to where I was today. My internship at NASA, the first one I had, I saw how much people there loved what they did. I was there during the shuttle program. There was a lot of excitement about the shuttle, a lot of excitement about, back then, the Constellation program, kind of the predecessor to Artemis, when we were going to send humans back to the moon. I was hooked. I wanted to be part of that. And I also want to say that for me personally, also having support was critical. So I had a lot of support from my parents. They drove me to space camp. They helped me research the right schools to go to. They were always there to support me. My husband now also. I will say that my journey wasn't easy. I was laughed at in high school for wanting to work at NASA. This was a very difficult part of my journey. I got so bad that I didn't want to tell people what I wanted to do because I was just so tired of being laughed at. I had a guidance counselor once tell me to change my dream because she did not want me to go to the school that I was going to go to. So there were obstacles along the way, but again, for me, it was just really critical to keep my eyes on my goals and to surround myself with people who would support me and not tear me down. So I just wanted to, I know you didn't really ask about that, but I wanted to make sure I threw that in as well.
That was great. Jerry.
I'd like to add one thing to what Bob said. We did have another advantage in the Apollo era. It was a turbulent time for the country, Vietnam War, campus unrest, two assassinations of key people up high in the government. But throughout that period, we had support from both sides of the aisle. The political process was smooth. And we had three presidents, two of them Democrats, one. We had Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon. And they never wavered in their support. So it was we had a better political situation than we have today. You guys are fighting in a terrible time that is hard to keep that balance. So.
Jerry, I will say that NASA still has bipartisan support. We have nonpartisan support in both houses of Congress on both sides of the aisle. They are supporting us, and even Senator Nelson, as our administrator, has done an awesome job. If it had not been for this ceiling that has been put on us, we had a president's recommended budget of $27.4 million going into the next year. Now we're looking at around 25, and so that's a huge hit to be able to accomplish what we need to do, but we're working on it, and I think I will say we do have bipartisan support.
Good to hear.
Thank you. That's great. Thank you. All right. I think we'd like to wrap up the evening with another video. This one is entitled "I Dreamed This," and it speaks to the inspiration of the program. So I thought it'd be an appropriate way to close the evening. So would you roll that for us, Chris?
You probably dreamed of this.
Liftoff on Apollo 11.
You probably replayed this moment a thousand times. You probably imagined the awe-inspiring, indescribable rush of the ride. You probably celebrated the miraculous, cheered the momentous, and mourned the shocking. You probably still dream of what could be. We did. We do. And while many thought we were through, no, We've been learning, we've been building, we've been training. And now, it's time. Because the next frontier is not just for the next generation. It's for this generation. It's for me, and it's for you. For everything we still dream about. We go as Artemis.
You're here. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for being here tonight. It's a full house, and we love that. And I think we could go on all night, but we need to call it good for there. And I want to ask you to give our great folks here another round of applause.